Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. The Second Amendment provides for a well-regulated militia and protects the right of the people to keep and bear arms. But a new book suggests that the Second Amendment does not apply to all Americans equally. In her book, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America, Emory University professor Carol Anderson argues that the Second Amendment was designed to put down slave rebellions and to render African Americans powerless. She says the effects are still being felt today. Carol Anderson is the Charles Howard Candler Professor and Chair of African American Studies at Emory University. She is also the author of One Person, No Vote, and the New York Times bestseller White Rage, among other books. She was named a Guggenheim Fellow for Constitutional Studies, and she joins us now to talk about her latest, The Second. Professor Anderson, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me, Tracy.
So you open the book with the story of Philando Castile as sort of a modern-day example of how the Second Amendment has failed black people. Let's start there. Remind us what happened in that case.
Here you have a black man in Minnesota who is pulled over by the police. When the police officer asked to see his ID, Philando Castile, following NRA guidelines, alerts the officer that he has a license to carry weapon with him, but that he is reaching for his ID the way that the police officer asked. The moment that Philando Castile said that, the police officer began shooting and killed him. And so here you have a black man who is killed simply for having a gun, a license to carry gun. He wasn't threatening the officer. He wasn't brandishing it at anyone. He merely had it. And the signal was danger, threat. Philando Castile is dead. The NRA goes virtually silent on Philando Castile. Eventually, it makes a statement that everybody has the right to bear arms. But you don't see the kind of intense backlash from the NRA, the way you saw with Ruby Ridge and with Waco, where the NRA called the federal officers jackbooted government thugs who will gun down law-abiding citizens and break into their homes and steal their weapons and those sorts of things. You didn't get that at all. And I was stunned by that. And you had journalists asking the question, well, don't African Americans have Second Amendment rights? And seeing what happened to Philando Castile, I thought that that was a great question, and I went hunting and ended up back in the 17th century.
Well, let's go back there. Let's rewind and go back to the 1600s, where you write about how there were deliberate legislative efforts by white colonists in the North as well as in the South to make sure that black people, whether they were enslaved or free in some cases, did not have the right to bear arms. What was that all about?
Yeah, and so it was about the fear of black people, the fear of enslaved people, the fear that the enslaved would want to rise up to get their freedom. And so it was, how do we remove access to those liberation tools from black people? Because black people are a threat. And this is one of the ideas that I see coursing through American history. The idea of African Americans as a threat, as dangerous, as a group of people that must be contained and whose rights must be curtailed. And there was a fear that that free blacks would incite these insurrections among the enslaved. And so free blacks had to be curtailed as well.
And yet, in spite of that, there were slave uprisings going all the way back to the 1600s.
Oh, absolutely. That quest for freedom is real. It is strong. And with each rumor of an uprising or with each revolt, you saw the architecture of control being put in place. You saw the slave codes that banned the enslaved from having weapons and from having books and from being denied literacy. You see the rise of the slave patrols, which are these smaller organizations that are there to enforce the slave codes. And so they would go into the slave cabins and they would look for contraband, such as books, such as writing implements, and such as weapons. And you had the rise of the militia. And the militia was there to really put down large slave revolts, the things that the slave patrols could not handle.
So you mentioned the militias, and I want to come back to that in just a moment. But while we're talking about uprisings, you write in the book that it wasn't just enslaved people who were rising up at that time, that there were uprisings by white people as well. Can you give us a couple of examples of that and how the militias handled them differently?
Yes, and so we had Shays' Rebellion. Shays' Rebellion came right before the Constitutional Convention, and it was a group of white men who were angry at the Massachusetts government for a taxation policy and for the seizure of property for non-payment of taxes. And so they attacked the Massachusetts government. Massachusetts then called out the militia to put down Shays' Rebellion. And the militia was like, no, we're not going to do that. We're just not feeling it. And in fact, you had some members of the militia join Shays' Rebellion. And that then led Boston merchants to fund a mercenary army to put down Shays' Rebellion. The response to that uprising by white men was to basically only prosecute a few, and then their sentences were commuted. And so you didn't see what you saw with Shays' Rebellion was white men attacking the government and very few consequences for it. When there was a slave revolt, the consequences were dire. You had disemboweling, you had beheadings. You had the heads of those who were engaged in the revolt being put on spikes and lining the pathways to the plantation as a warning to the enslaved. This is what will happen to you if you dare believe that you have the right to be free.
And so the militias were critically important at that time, and you write about how the colonists had an aversion to a standing army, that they much preferred the idea of the local militia. What was the aversion to a standing army about?
That was about the British and the redcoats. That was seeing that a standing army was foundational for tyranny, that a standing army allowed the government to overwhelm the will of the people. And so this is why we have this narrative now about how wonderful the militia was in fending off the British, in fighting for American freedom, fighting for American liberty. But that doesn't track with what was happening on the ground at the time. Sometimes the militia during the War for Independence, sometimes the militias would show up, sometimes they wouldn't. Sometimes they'd fight, sometimes they'd take off running. George Washington was beside himself at how unreliable the militia were in terms of taking on a professional army, in terms of fending off a foreign invasion. It was the Continental Army that really did a lot of the heavy, effective fighting. And that Continental Army got stronger once the colonies offered freedom to the enslaved in the North, in the North, offered freedom to enslaved men to join that army because you couldn't get enough white men who were willing to enlist in the Continental Army.
Well, it was so interesting what you wrote about that, because you said that the Revolutionary War really presented a dilemma for colonists because there were not enough white men to fight, and yet there was a great deal of resistance, particularly in the South, to enlisting black men.
Oh, absolutely. So once that Continental Army, which was a fully integrated army, stiffened and the British were heading a series of defeats, that they then decided to move south to what they call the soft underbelly of the revolt. And so they attacked Georgia and knocked Georgia out virtually immediately. Then they were headed up to Charleston, South Carolina. And George Washington sent his emissary, John Lawrence, to the South Carolina government saying, look, you only have 750 white men available to take on a British army of 8,000. thousand people. You need to arm the enslaved. You need to arm the enslaved. That's the only way we're going to be able to win this war. And the South Carolina government looked at Lawrence and said, "We are appalled that you would even ask this of us. We are horrified. We are alarmed. And it makes us wonder whether this is a nation even worth fighting for." And they were willing to broach independence. They were willing to broach removing themselves from the war and taking their chances with the British rather than arming the enslaved. Nathaniel Greene, General Nathaniel Greene, said that as he kept pounding on them, "You've got to arm the enslaved." What he said, he went back to George Washington. And he said, "They said no because they have a dreaded fear of armed blacks."
And that was not true of the British Army because they were readily willing to accept black fighters.
Yes, a Lord, the Earl of Dunmore had offered, he was the royal governor of Virginia. He had offered freedom to any enslaved man who worked on a plantation for one of the rebels, that if you come and you fight for the king, you will be free. So that offer of freedom had blacks flocking to the British. And the role of African Americans in that battle with the British is interesting in that you have a lot of the same kind of racism there of, okay, they can do labor battalions, but it was a way of draining the resources away from the rebels, and putting those resources into the hands of the king.
So I have about 60 seconds until we have to take a break here, but I'm wondering if you can sort of break down for us. You said that, there it was the fear of black people, but how much was also the fear that you mentioned of having a standing army and sort of bad memories of the Redcoats, fear of a too powerful central government? I mean, how do you sort of rank those three items? What did the colonists fear the most?
In the ratification convention in Virginia, what you heard most say, being most salient, was the fear of having this powerful central government controlling the militia and that that militia would not be deployed against a slave revolt and that those slave owners in Virginia would be left defenseless.
Well, we have much more that we want to discuss. We're going to take a break in just a moment, but we're talking with Professor Carol Anderson from Emory University. She is the author of The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. She traces this from the 1600s all the way up to the present day. We have much more to talk about with her. You can join the conversation by emailing us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And we'll be back right after this.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscoane. If you're just joining us, we are talking with Professor Carol Anderson from Emory University about her new book, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. In the book, she argues that the origins of the Second Amendment were based more on a fundamental fear of black people than fear of government tyranny. The well-regulated militia clause, she says, was more reflective of white colonists wanting to police black people and wanting to be armed because they feared slave revolts. You can join in the conversation by tweeting us at WHYY Radio Times. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can give us a call at 888-477-9499. Professor Anderson, I want to talk about the Second Amendment itself, which was passed in 1791. Of course, it was part of the larger Bill of Rights. And around that time, there were a couple of other laws that were passed that you said in the book, you said they strengthened the anti-blackness of the Second Amendment. What did you mean by that?
That the Second Amendment was really put in place as a bribe to the South to not undermine the Constitution and to not have a new constitutional convention. It was the same way that bribe of the Three-Fifths Clause, the bribe of the Atlantic slave trade for an additional 20 years, and the bribe of the Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution. It was the way that the South played hardball. And what I saw then with the actual founding of the United States, as you have the Congress making these laws, one of the first ones was there was a petition from Benjamin Franklin and the Quakers to give Congress the power to end slavery. And that blew up that Congress. And James Madison, seeing how the issue of slavery could just destroy the United States of America, maneuvered through Congress to have a statement saying that Congress does not have the power to look at what is happening on the conditions of slavery in each of the states, nor to end slavery. Then you have the Naturalization Act. And that Naturalization Act was set out to define who can be an American, what immigrant can be an American. And it was based on the census, but the census didn't have anything in there about who was an immigrant. And what they really came down to was if you were white, then you could be an American. And so it's linking citizenship with whiteness. Then there was the Uniform Militia Act, and the Uniform Militia Act said that all able-bodied white men between the ages of 18 and 45 had to join the militia, and they had to have a gun. And you see then that this role of the militia is part of the citizenship of being an American, and it's identified as white men with a gun. And again, the role of the militia, you have in the South, the role of the militia is to put down slave revolts. One of the things that you do see is that the role of the militia in the North is to deal with the fending off indigenous people who want their land and who are angry that their land is being taken from them. And so you have this kind of fear of people who are not white. And the role of the militia is to fend them off, to keep them down, and to eviscerate their rights.
And all around this time in 1791, just a few months before the Second Amendment was passed, you had the Haitian Revolution. And so that had some impact, certainly, in this country. Talk about how that impacted the conversation around slavery in the United States.
The Haitian Revolution is when the enslaved in Haiti rose up to overthrow that slaveocracy that was on top of them. They were fighting for freedom, and they were deploying the vision. This was the age of revolution. You had the American Revolution, then you had the French Revolution, and now you had the Haitian Revolution. And for whites in America, it was, wait a minute, these revolutionary ideas, this is a white-only thing. Why do these black people think they have the right to self-government? Why do they think they have the right to be free? And the violence that it took to move that slaveocracy off of the Haitians just scared, the scholarly term is the bejeebers out of the colonists. And so as you had the white slave owners from Haiti fleeing Haiti with the enslaved. Like in Baltimore, when they showed up at Baltimore, Baltimore opened up the public armory to the public, to the white public, saying, you know, the Haitians are coming. The Haitians are coming. They're a threat. You've got to defend yourself. In Virginia, the fear was that these ideas of freedom, of liberty, of self-determination, of democracy that the Haitians were bringing, that would infect the enslaved in Virginia and make them insolent, make them want their own freedom. They had been wanting their own freedom for a long, long time. But what you had in 1800 was Gabriel's Revolt. And Gabriel's Revolt in Virginia, he was a black man who was enslaved, and he had managed to pull together a multi-city, multi-county plan for revolt to form their own multi-ethnic, multi-racial democracy. Wow. Where he was like, where you get paid for your labor, where your rights are respected. And that revolt was undermined by a massive thunderstorm that damaged the logistics of everybody being able to meet up at a certain spot. And when Governor James Monroe found out about it, he was alarmed, alarmed. And it fed into that narrative that had been happening among the founding fathers, where Thomas Jefferson said, if this evil gets among us, we are in trouble. It is where, and it was like, oh my God, that evil is here. And that evil was black people believing they had the right to be free.
And there was someone, and I can't remember who it was that you quoted in your book, that said something like, "The slave once armed will be our master."
Yes, there is, again, it was that fear that if black people were armed, that what they would do is that they would do to whites what whites had done to them. So that fear of a black revolt, that fear of retribution, and it was a fear that was also born of guilt. I mean, one of the things that you also see coursing through in this era is the realization that the narratives that the founding fathers had crafted about the docility of the enslaved, about the benevolence of slavery, that when they had to peel back, they knew that what they were saying was just a load of hooey, another scholarly term. That when they say, if they're armed, they will be our master. When they say that when Benjamin Franklin was talking about the South was arguing that they shouldn't be taxed on their slave on the numbers of the slaves as headcount because slaves were property. And why would we count? Why would we count our property? We don't count your sheep up there in the North. And Benjamin Franklin said, "But sheep will never make a revolution." And it's that understanding of the quest for freedom in this enslaved black population and the fear that just resonated throughout the colonies among whites creates this incredible architecture. And that when I call that fear, that's the fear, that's that anti-blackness that is defining black people as dangerous, as a threat, as inherently criminal.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. We are talking with Professor Carol Anderson from Emory University about her book, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. I want to fast forward now to Civil War times and just after the Civil War, where we enter Reconstruction. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were passed, along with some other laws that were designed to protect the freedom and the rights of black people. But instead of things getting better, they got markedly worse, especially for any black person who was armed. What were some of the things that were going on around that time?
You had President Andrew Johnson, who basically provided blanket amnesty to many of the Confederate leaders, which allowed them to regain control of those Southern governments. And those governments then instituted what are called the Black Codes. And the Black Codes were to reinstall slavery by another name in terms of controlling Black people's labor and movements, but also in terms of disarming. So the Black Codes had that Black people could not bear arms. And you had the rise of these paramilitary groups working in league with these neo-Confederate governments to try to disarm Black people and to rain down to put down a reign of terror on black folks. The slaughter was just intense. Carl Schurz, who came to the South as to do a basically a to understand what the conditions were in 1865. And he just described black bodies upon black bodies, just the slaughter. And he was like, this is sickening. It is sickening. The smell of burning flesh, the dismemberment, the decomposing bodies, the hanging in the trees. Annette Gordon Reed, historian Annette Gordon Reed, called it a slow motion genocide. Then you had black troops who were part of the occupying army in the South, and they saw their role as protecting the freed people from this slaughter. But what that did, what you had whites then going to Andrew Johnson saying that the reason why there's this slaughter is seeing all of these black men strutting around in these uniforms with these guns, and you know that what they want to do is to kill all of the white people. If you remove these black troops, then there will be peace in the South. Now, that is a real interesting definition of peace. That is also a misreading of what is causing that violence. But Andrew Johnson removed the black troops from the South as part of the occupying army. That did not end the violence. You saw the rise of the KKK. Then we get the Colfax Massacre in 1873, where there is an election in Colfax, Louisiana, and whites do not like the results of that election. The right wing of whites do not like the results of that election. And they organize and mobilize to attack the courthouse, which is the seat of government in Colfax, Louisiana, to basically stage a coup. The black militia is there to try to defend that democracy, that seat of democracy, and they are overwhelmed and they are slaughtered. And one of the acts was the Third Enforcement Act, which was to stop the white domestic terrorism that was happening in the South by the Klan. Members of the Colfax Massacre, those who had instituted that massacre, were then charged under the Third Enforcement Act. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled that that act only applied to state actors, not to private actors. And so the men who had slaughtered over 100 black militiamen were set free. And it basically gave rein to the violence of white domestic terrorism. And you had President Ulysses S. Grant after Colfax and then after another massacre in Hamburg, South Carolina, say, you know what these places have in common? It's not Christianity. It's not civilization. It is the right to kill Negroes.
Well, and as we move then from Reconstruction and it gives way to Jim Crow, and you just mentioned that there was the rise of the Klan, we're seeing race riots now intensifying all across the country. Atlanta was a real hotspot. Later on, Tulsa, where we just observed the 100th anniversary of the Greenwood Massacre. And at that time, black people were taking up arms to defend themselves and usually paid a heavy price, as we saw in Greenwood, for doing so. I'm interested in your thoughts around that and also the role of the media at that time in shaping race relations.
So one of the things, for instance, in Atlanta, with the Atlanta race riot of 1906, you had the media hopping on and promulgating this narrative of black men raping white women, assaulting white women. And this becomes one of the foundational principles of white supremacy and of Jim Crow, the protection, the sanctity of white womanhood. And as the media keeps, you know, the papers are just fueling this. And the more they keep harping on this and their rumors, it's not even true. Their circulation is exploding and it's fueling this fire that then leads to the slaughter of black people. And as black folks fight back, you get the disproportionate power of when they shoot back, then whites call in the power of the state, the National Guard that comes in with heavy artillery, machinery to just mow down black folks. We saw this happen in in Atlanta. We see it in Knoxville, Tennessee in 1919. We see it in Elaine, Arkansas in 1919, where you had black sharecroppers who were had their wages stolen. So they're organizing a labor union in order to protect their labor rights, their rights to be paid for their labor. And they say, we know that if the whites find out, they will kill us. And so they post sentries out at by the church where they are meeting. And the sentries then see a car come up because whites had found out about it. And the sentries, there's this, they see this, they see this car, there's an exchange of gunfire, a white man is killed, another white man is wounded. Word gets back to the town that blacks are organizing. These are insurgents. These are Bolsheviks, because this is right after the First World War. These are Bolsheviks who are out to slaughter all of the whites in Elaine, Arkansas. The mob descends on that black community. Black folks shoot back. Two white men are killed. And then that leads the governor to bring in the U.S. Army, that brings in machine guns that have been used in the war in France to mow down black people. Somewhere around 800 or so were killed in Elaine, Arkansas.
So, and in our last 30 seconds here before we go to a break, just very quickly, you know, we've talked about how the records, so many of the records from Greenwood disappeared, and so much of this history we have not known until books like yours and others have come out. Were records destroyed in these other cases as well?
You had in some cases, yes. In some cases there were, but there were still these diaries, these newspaper accounts. Sometimes you've got the orders coming in from the governor that you can begin to piece together what happened, and the oral histories from black folks who survived the slaughter.
I'm going to stop you right there. We're going to take a quick break. We're talking with Carol Anderson, author of The Second. We'd love to hear from you. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back right after this.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
And welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about the Second Amendment. Specifically, we're talking about the new book, The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. The author is Professor Carol Anderson from Emory University. And the premise of the book is that the Second Amendment is not so much about guns as it is about the fear of armed African Americans. That's what we've been talking about. You're welcome to join in the conversation. If you've got some questions for Professor Anderson, you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can always call us 888-477-9499. Carol Anderson, I want to fast forward now into the 20th century and up to the present day, but I'm thinking about the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s, and again, how we see legislation passed that is designed to protect and even expand in some cases the rights of black people. But when it comes to guns, not so much. What was happening around that time?
Not so much. We had in California, massive police brutality was raining down on the black community in Oakland. And there was no accountability in that system. And so the black community rose up with the rise of the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, co-founded by Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale. And they saw their role as policing the police, and they knew what the laws were. And so they would openly carry weapons and monitor police arrest. They knew the kinds of weapons they could carry. They knew how they had to carry those weapons, and they knew the distance that they had to maintain from the police as the police were arresting black folk. Well, the police did not like to be monitored. They most certainly did not like to be monitored by the Black Panthers. And so they would try to pull them over and arrest them on things, but they couldn't arrest them because their guns were legal. The kinds of guns that they had were licensed. They were the kinds of guns that you're able to carry, so no sawed-off shotguns. And they knew the rules. And so the police run to Assemblyman Don Mulford, who is part of the California legislature, and said, "You've got to help us. The Black Panthers are a problem, a serious problem." And so Mulford begins drafting, with the help of the NRA, laws to ban open carry in California. And it was targeted at the Panthers. Now, Don Mulford said, no, there was no racial targeting in this law at all, except when you read the correspondence, you see that the Black Panthers are the target of this law. It was a way to make what the Panthers were doing illegal, to make the Panthers illegal.
And I can imagine someone hearing this and saying, well, wait a minute, aren't there other laws that are designed to bolster Second Amendment rights? You know, what about the Castle Doctrine? What about the Stand Your Ground laws? Don't they mitigate in some way what you're talking about?
And the answer is, as I did the research, the answer is no. So let's take Stand Your Ground. Stand Your Ground was passed in 2005 in Florida and then spread out through many states in the United States. And what Stand Your Ground does is it says you have the right to defend yourself, to stand your ground, any place where you have a right to be. So if I'm at the grocery store, if I'm in church, if I'm in a parking lot, if I'm at school, right? No, well, and not maybe school, but if wherever I have a right to be, I have the right to stand my ground when I perceive a threat. And it is that perception of threat that becomes the tripwire in this law, because Black is the default threat in the United States. I mean, it is the scary Black man. It is what allowed George Zimmerman to stalk with a loaded weapon Trayvon Martin through a neighborhood and kill that child and be able to walk away because he was threatened by this child. It is what leads to when whites kill Blacks under Stand Your Ground, they are 10 times more likely to walk than when Blacks kill whites under Stand Your Ground. 10 times. When whites kill Blacks, they are 281% more likely to walk under Stand Your Ground than when whites kill whites. When Black is the default threat, this is the disparity that you see in the ways that Stand Your Ground, the right to self-defense, is actually deployed. When you think about open carry, that is, again, to be one of those hallmark Second Amendment rights. But what we see happening, for instance, with Tamir Rice, the 12-year-old boy in Cleveland, Ohio, who was playing in a park by himself with a toy gun. And granted, the toy did not have the orange tip on it, but open carry says, as long as you're not threatening anyone. Well, he's in a park by himself. He's not threatening anyone. But the police rolled up, and within 2 seconds, they shot him down. And they said he was a threat. He was dangerous. And this is an open carry state. You see that with John Crawford, again, in Ohio, who is in a Walmart, and he picks up a BB gun that is on the shelf that Walmart is selling. And he's carrying it around with him in the store while he's getting the fixings for some s'mores. And a white couple calls 911 saying, there's a Black guy in here with a gun and he's threatening children and he's waving this rifle all around. And so police rush in because they think they're in an active shooter situation. This is a Black man carrying a BB gun in a store that sells BB guns in an open carry state. John Crawford is shot dead. So this issue of open carry, this issue of the Castle Doctrine, with the Castle Doctrine, just think about Breonna Taylor. So she's in her apartment, her home. The Castle Doctrine says you have the right to defend yourself if somebody comes into your home that is not a relative and is not supposed to be there. And the door is breached. Her boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, has his gun. He shoots, and an array of bullets just rain down into that apartment. Five of the bullets and a projectile hit Breonna Taylor and kill her. It says, and Daniel Cameron, the Attorney General of Kentucky, says this was justifiable. Justifiable. She did not have the right to defend herself. Her castle doctrine, her castle was breached. And the police did not identify themselves. The same thing happened here in Atlanta, Georgia, with a 92-year-old woman, black woman named Katherine Johnston, who is in her house. She hears the burglar bars being removed from the door in the early morning hours, and she gets her rusty revolver to defend herself. As the folks come through the door, she shoots. It's actually the cops, and they gun her down. So Castle Doctrine does not apply for black folks. Stand Your Ground does not apply for black folks. Open carry does not apply for black folks. Think about Kyle Rittenhouse, the white teenager who crossed state lines with an illegally obtained AR-15 to go to Kenosha, Wisconsin. And because there was a protest there, because a black man had been shot in the back 7 times. And so as Kyle Rittenhouse comes in there, the police see him and they don't see threat. Instead, they welcome this white teenager with this AR-15 saying, "We really appreciate you guys being here. It's hot out here. You want some water?" Rittenhouse then goes on and he guns down 3 men, killing 2 and seriously wounding another. As he walks back towards the police with his hands up as if to surrender, the police let him go right on by, that he doesn't register as threat. But Tamir Rice, who is playing in a park by himself, is immediately seen as a threat, and he is shot within 2 seconds.
I have a number of questions that I want to try to get in our last few minutes here, Carol. One comes from Catherine, who asks, "I wonder whether there were any white allies at all for enslaved or struggling freed black people in the South during these times, and perhaps even to expand the question to times beyond that, to talk about what allies there may have been."
Yes. And so there was Elijah Lovejoy, who was a white man in Illinois, who had an abolitionist printing press, and his press kept getting destroyed. And he finally got a gun to protect himself and protect his printing press, to protect his business. And he was killed. And the folks who killed him were able to walk away with not guilty. So you had white abolitionists who were fighting as well for black freedom. And generally, they were treated just horribly. There's this one instance where that did not happen. And it was after the 1850 Fugitive Slave Act, which the North hated. And so there's this battle in Christiana, Pennsylvania, where a slave owner named Edward Gorsuch from Maryland comes up to Christiana to get what he calls his property. And there is a battle, and Gorsuch is killed. And there is a subsequent trial, and they try to call this treason for not backing the Fugitive Slave Act. And the judge was, "This isn't treason. This is black folks defending themselves." And so no one was convicted of Gorsuch's death. Mm. So when there is this interest convergence between whites and blacks, you will see movement on this right to self-defense or this right to bear arms. So like when there is a war and there aren't enough white men to then recruit black men, because the exigencies of war require that. But like after the First World War, you saw this massive pushback because these black soldiers got a taste of democracy. And then they were coming back to the United States and they needed to be re-educated that that democracy did not mean them.
Carol, you have this habit of writing incredibly timely books, and we would be remiss if we didn't ask you before we wrap up our conversation about your book, One Person, No Vote, because certainly we have been watching all across the country as state legislature after state legislature brings forth these more restrictive voting laws. We know that just yesterday the Supreme Court had a ruling on Arizona voting laws, and would love to hear your perspective as someone who has been writing about this for a long time as to where we're headed with all of this.
We are in trouble. We are in that moment that is where the courts undermine the laws of Reconstruction. They undermine the 13th, the 14th, the 15th, and the Enforcement Acts that then left large swaths of the population vulnerable to terror and to the evisceration of their rights. And this is what you're seeing happening now, where the court is saying that there has to be the disparate burden of racism on these voting laws has to be really disparate. And that you can't have, that the states can basically implement these laws and the burden of the damage is on the people who are being destroyed, whose rights are being destroyed by these voting laws. It is a horrific moment that we're in as we're seeing these states who are angry that black folks, that Native Americans, that Hispanics, and that Asian American Pacific Islanders, as well as poor people and young people, came out to vote, that they engaged in this democracy. That is a threat to a small strata of folk who are holding on to power at all costs. Our democracy is in trouble.
So, and that was actually my next question, because that is certainly a big topic of conversation right now. Many people are questioning, you know, is our democracy in danger, and are things about to change in this country? Can you elaborate a little bit on your thoughts about that, about where we are as a democracy?
We're at a place where you have a strata of folk who believe that there are only legitimate Americans and that a vote coming in. So when you heard the big lie about the big steal, that those people in Detroit voted, those people in Philadelphia, those people in Milwaukee, those people in Atlanta, that those people, those votes should not count, because they're not legitimate Americans. Think about how destructive that is out there in our political biosphere, and that you have government agents working on that premise about illegitimate Americans. And that illegitimacy is predicated on race and class. It is, and that you've got the courts, the Supreme Court, that is in league with that. When you look at a series of Supreme Court decisions from Shelby County to the one allowing extreme partisan gerrymandering to the one that's allowing massive voter roll purges simply for not voting regularly in federal elections, now to this one that guts Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, you're having the sanctioning of who are legitimate Americans.
Carol Anderson, I have one last question in 30 seconds before we say goodbye. You write about such heavy topics, about, you know, voting restrictions, about gun laws. We are living in a very difficult time. What gives you hope in the midst of all of this?
It is the way that we continue to fight for this democracy. That is what this history tells us, that there are people who see the vision, who see the aspiration, and are willing to fight to make that aspiration of we the people and that all men are created equal a reality in this nation.
The book is The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. The author is Carol Anderson. Carol, thank you so much for making the time to be with us here on Radio Times.
Thank you so much, Tracy.
Our engineer has been Diana Martinez, and our producers are Debbie Builder and Paige Murray-Bressler. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.